Away with Words, Part 3, Lecture 2. What is grammar?
So I just managed to do an entire lecture on grammar without ever defining what grammar was. That, by the way, was completely intentional and not ineptitude on my part, Drought said after the fact. But seriously, I could get away with that approach because I knew that you had a pretty good idea of what I meant by grammar, and that if people start talking about grammar, if they say, I better watch my grammar, we all sort of know what we're talking about. Well, I mean, that's nice for casual conversation. That's an easy way to communicate. We talk about grammar. We sort of understand it. But now we sort of need to build up not so much a formal definition, though that's useful also. But we need to build up an understanding of what scholars mean when they're talking about grammar and how it's different from, say, what eighth grade English teachers mean, what regular normal people mean, what linguists mean, what philologists mean, and what cognitive psychologists mean. There's a core there, so don't worry. It's not going to be like a blizzard of 3,000 different definitions. There's a core. But we need to know what different people are getting at so we don't talk past each other when we're talking about grammar. So a few years back, I was doing some research at Oxford, and I was walking around at Oxford. It was off term, so there were no students there. It was very empty and very rainy and very cold. But I was walking around Oxford, and over by Radcliffe Camera in Oxford, that's this beautiful round building, there's a set of doorways that have above them School of X, School of Y, and one of them said School of Grammar. And I made my wife take a picture of me standing inside the archway of the School of Grammar because I love grammar that much. And in fact, I would like to change my name from Professor Michael Drought to Michael Grammaticus. I'm not really making that up. I'm not allowed to do it. And I'm saying this because it goes back to the Middle Ages, actually. And for me, my technical research is on medieval literature. I'm a specialist in Old English. I do work in Middle English and the history of the language. So anything medieval is good for me. But in the Middle Ages, you could get the special last name Grammaticus. And there's a famous writer called Saxo Grammaticus. He's a Danish writer. And if you were named Saxo Grammaticus, or like I would like to be named Michael Grammaticus, that didn't mean really anything besides just Saxo, who could read and write. Grammaticus simply meant you could read and write, and that's an important part that I'll get to in a second. But it didn't mean Saxo, undangler of participles, joiner of infinitives. It just meant Saxo could read and write. But I still wouldn't mind being Michael Grammaticus. Now, why is there that connection to reading and writing? And this is really important to understand about grammar. In the Middle Ages, grammar was all about writing. This is linked even further back to graphein, to draw or write. And so it's coming from Greek into Latin, into the Middle Ages, into English. And in English, in fact, grammar has an association even with magic, believe it or not. The word glamour. Now we think of glamorous or Hollywood, but glamour originally meant something somewhat magical or unusual, and that is related to the word grammar. And there is still at Oxford today a master of glomeria, and that's the person whose job is to teach Latin to undergraduates. Actually, by this point at Oxford, it's the person whose job is it to assign graduate students to teach Latin to undergraduates. But nevertheless, I think it'd be pretty cool to be the master of glomery, or the master of grammar, or Michael Grammaticus. And I'd like to bring back that Grammaticus tag. So in fact, I'm going to ask my producers that instead of putting by Professor Michael D.C. Drought, that they say by Michael Grammaticus on the cover of this course. Okay. I don't think that's going to fly, but I'll still say, please make a note of that. Now, as I just pointed out, grammar is one of those places where the etymology, the history of a word, the back history of a word, is not terribly illuminating. Because what grammar meant to people in ancient Greece, in Rome, and then further into medieval England and the universities all throughout the continent was, could you read and write in Latin? And in the late antique and the classical period, it actually meant, could you read and write in Greek? Because if you couldn't read and write in Greek, well, I mean, you just didn't know anything. And then later on, after Greek dies out in the West for a long time, it was simply, could you read and write in Latin? But that's what being a grammaticus meant. And that's not at all what contemporary scholars mean when they talk about grammar, or even your eighth grade English teacher meant when she talked about grammar. So we had that tradition of Greek and Latin grammar going back, but there was also a different tradition, completely separate, which was going on in India. People don't usually think of this as being part of the grammatical tradition, but it was. In India, there were a lot of sacred texts that were written in the language Sanskrit, and those were preserved and even memorized and transmitted, and scholars studied them even after the language had changed away from Sanskrit. So India had for a very, very long time, and completely separate from the West, a study of ancient languages and how they had changed. There were Indian grammarians who were really doing things that we would now say linguists do hundreds and hundreds of years ago. And they decided that grammar wasn't only about writing, but it was about the way that words were put together and the way that language changed. So there was a convergence of traditions of the ancient Sanskrit grammarians with the development of philology and historical linguistics in the 19th century. And what happened eventually, which I'll describe in more detail later in the course, but just to set it up right now, is that British scholars realized that there was an essential connection between Sanskrit, the ancient language in India, and Greek and Latin and Celtic languages like Irish and Germanic languages like English and German. And when they realized all these languages were related to each other, they started to study how one had changed into the other, and we got what's called comparative philology. And out of that discipline, we eventually got, which I'm not going to go into all the details now, but we eventually got what's now considered linguistics, which is the study of languages. So what happens is you eventually change the meaning of grammatical from just, can I read and write, and can I read and write in such a way that people like what I write or that it's similar to the ancient authorities, to how does language work in the abstract? And this is where we can get a technical definition of grammar started. Technically, grammar is the way in which words are put together in language to express things. And each language has its own grammar. Furthermore, the grammar of the language is a system of arrangements. It's a bunch of rules in that language for communicating meaning. So a remarkable thing about grammars, then, is that for all natural languages, in other words, for things that are not made up like Esperanto or Klingon or Elvish, and there's a really quite large number of invented languages, but skipping those, set those aside because those are not the same. But for all natural languages that people grow up speaking and learn as children without formal instruction, all the grammars are what are mathematically called closed systems. You don't need to go outside the rules of the grammar to find an explanation for the production of all the meaningful statements in that language. Not only that, but all grammar systems from every known language in the world, the most obscure and old and the newest and most evolved and largest, which would turn out to be English, which is probably the most copious language in the world right now with the largest number of words, all of those grammars, from the smallest to the largest, can produce an infinite number of grammatical sentences, even though they only have a finite number of words and rules. This is actually quite remarkable, and it's a neat mathematical trick, which I'll explain in a little bit. Now, the other thing to think about when thinking about grammar is to realize that grammar evolved long, long before writing. In fact, there's all these different comparisons. My favorite one is if you think of the history of human language as a calendar. Okay, so instead of thousands and thousands and thousands of years or even millions of years, think of it as 12 months. Writing only emerges late in December. All the rest of the back history is before writing. I mean, writing 5,000 years old, maybe some of the very oldest things, maybe 6,000, and really alphabetic writing, much, much, much more recent. But we still had grammar. And this is really important because almost all the rules of grammar are based on sound rather than on writing. And this is a surprisingly hard idea to get your head around. Because you just said, oh yes, of course, it's based on sound, it's based on how people speak. But think about it, the word grammar itself means writing. So, on the one hand, writing, studying writing, how things are put together, let's lay it out on a page, let's look at how the sentences are combined. On the other, all the underlying rules were based on speech. And because we live in a literate age, and some people would say post-literate, but I'm not going there yet, we conceptualize our ideas about grammar in terms of writing. But that's actually wrong. So when I teach students linguistics or historical philology, one of the first things we have to do is to try to get ourselves to thinking of words in terms of sounds rather than in terms of black marks on pieces of paper. Because those little black marks on the pieces of paper are what we have now. We link grammar to that. But that's not where the rules came from. And in fact, there are a few grammatical rules in English that happened after the invention of writing, but the great majority, even in English, and remember, most of the changes in English have happened within the past 1,000 years or 1,500 years, and there's been writing that entire time, and nevertheless, it's still based on sound. So we sort of have to do a double move here. We study things on paper, we look at how they are on paper, then we have to convert them into sound in our heads. We have to think about how the sounds would be pronounced. We have to think about how people would have heard the sounds also. And then we have to go back and think about it in writing again. Now, I think the good fortune of all of this is that I'm doing this for recorded books, and you folks are hearing this now. So we've saved one step. I have to convert everything into sound, but you don't. You can just hear it. And so that actually might make grammar easier to learn, even though grammar's, you know, about writing. By the way, this is what some people mean when they talk about post-literate. Recorded books is a great example of post-literate culture, in that I wrote down the notes for my lectures, and I read things in books for them, and I wrote the course book, and I studied all how the stuff to get together, but now I'm going to produce it orally, and you're going to hear it orally, A-U, oral, and you're going to process it there without the intermediary of the page until you go and look at the course book or read the suggested readings and so forth. So this is post-literate, if you get all theoretical, right? Because you're encountering it orally, but it's all done in a literate way. But it's even more post-literate in this sense. I'm not reading a script. My producer won't let me write scripts. I have to improvise from notes. And that's a good thing for the way you want to hear it. And it's the same basic principle, actually, of reality television. People don't like the way people read and act to a script unless you're highly skilled at it, like a really good actor. But if you're talking in notes, then you don't sound like you're reading, and that's the whole point. And that's what post-literate's all about. It's moved from writing, past writing, into something else. And just to kind of conclude this little digression, I'll point out that I spent way more time writing the notes for these lectures and then setting them all up than I do actually recording them or you do listening to them. And this is another kind of fundamental, what's called asymmetry in communication, that it takes a long time to write and a really short time to read. The same thing with anything with the graphic part. On the other hand, we can speak and understand and produce speech just about as fast as we can hear it from someone else. And that's a kind of interesting dynamic to the literate-oral distinction. So again, let's get back to grammar now. A grammar is a set of rules by which we can combine words to produce meanings. Now, that's a great start, except we haven't defined what we mean by words. You think, so what? I know what a word is. But it turns out that there is a huge definitional problem in the word word. And you may have noticed the irony there, that defining a word is a problem, but dictionary definitions are arranged according to words, are made up of words. I mean, Bill Clinton's, that all depends on what the meaning of is nothing compared to the problem of defining a word. But really, I brought that up so I could use the word is 3 times in a grammatical sentence, which I just did. And that grammatical usage of is probably a world record, except that now I just did 4, so maybe that's the world record. Woo! So, just wanted to get lots of is's together in a technically grammatical sentence. But let's get back to the main point here. A word is a problem in both a pre-literate society and to some degree in a post-literate society. So that's pretty much most of human existence. Because the boundaries between one word and the next are not nearly as clear in speech as they are in writing. Remember, in writing, we have black marks with white space on either side, so we've got words. But try listening to someone speak in a completely foreign language. You've all done it. You've been somewhere, you've heard people talking at a restaurant, and you have no idea where the word boundaries even are. You just hear sounds flowing together. And that's because acoustically, the boundaries between words are not entirely obvious. In fact, your intuition is surprisingly the right one. I know this in kind of excruciating detail because I run a website called anglosaxonaloud.com where I'm posting the entire Old English poetic records, all 30,000 lines of poetry, 100 lines a day. So it's just about done and they'll all be up there. And every day I record 100 lines or so of poetry in Old English. And then I use a sound editing program to clean up all the mistakes and, you know, the disgusting mouth sounds. Or my favorite one, when just as I was finished recording part of The Seafarer, one of those beautiful Anglo-Saxon poems, from the other room, you hear my son going, "Daddy, I did a poop!" And I kind of had to erase that out of there. And when you do sound editing, it turns out the computer gives you a graphical representation of the sound. It's called a sonogram. It's little bars of volume. And a good sound editor can then cut out all the bad things just by highlighting with the mouse and then cutting and pasting. Well, what I discovered was that it's not always easy to cut in between any one word because one word blurs into the next. And I've posted an example of one of these sonograms at the Anglo-Saxon Loud website, and I'm putting one in the course book so you can see what this looks like. But you can see the divisions between some words. There's an actual gap or a pause. But others, there's a big blur, particularly when it's small words like prepositions. So if I say, "I am going to the store," the difference between "to the store" is not something that you can easily cut out. The sounds tend to blur into one another. Now, the point here is that a word, if you don't have writing, is pretty difficult to define. Oral traditional societies use the word "word," but they really mean an utterance. So in an oral traditional society, an entire proverb can be a word. You can have someone say, "A stitch in time saves nine," and that counts as one word in an oral traditional society. Likewise, in a literate society, a grammatical marker like the past tense, right, the ED at the end of a word, well, we think of that as being part of a word, but in traditional grammar, that can be taken out and moved around and shifted and other things changed and put in, or something like "of" or "and," which don't really mean anything by themselves, right? You try writing a definition of, or the definition of "and." It's a function word. It's a grammatical symbol, really, and those are grammatical markers, so they're not real words in the sense that they would have a definition. So our definition of word is pretty complicated. And wait! It gets worse! Grammar includes not only how we string words together, but how we create and how we change words themselves. Let me give you an example here. Cow is one word. Cows is another word, meaning more than one cow. And cows is still another word, and it sounds exactly the same as cows. What I mean is cows, cow apostrophe S, like belonging to the cow, and cows, plural. Sounds exactly the same. Now we can add in some other words, cow-like, cow-ish, uncow-like, cow-esque, and so forth. And with all these words, we've just taken a root, cow, and tacked on different endings to them. But we are communicating with those endings grammatical ideas as well as definitional ideas. So for example, when I stick an S on the end of the word cow, I don't get a new dictionary definition, right? I don't get, okay, cow, and then see cows, plural of cow. You just don't do that. Your dictionary would be so immense you could never even think of carrying it around. That adding an S to a word makes it a plural. Adding apostrophe S, which sounds exactly the same as S, makes it a possessive. By the way, if you want to know why people have trouble learning English when they've grown up speaking another language, cows apostrophe S versus cows, plural, is one reason why. Those things sound exactly the same, obviously, and we have to have other ways of figuring them out. But that sets up one of the problems with our definition of grammar. It's not just how whole words are arranged, but it's about the grammatical markings that enter into other words. Now, linguists, by the way, have a better system for describing these things. They call the arrangement of whole words in sentences syntax, and the rules governing changes within words, like cows and cows belonging to the cows, morphology. And really good linguists come up with definitions of syntax versus morphology for any language. For example, there are languages out there called agglutinative languages, where the words just keep getting bigger and bigger and bigger. And you can eventually communicate pretty much what we would in English think of as a sentence worth of information in one word based on all the different prefixes and suffixes and infixes, things that go in the middle. So this is all actually part of grammar, even though we think of it as being as words. And I'm bringing this up because one of the better books about grammar and linguistics is by Steven Pinker, and it's called Words and Rules. And he argues in a pretty convincing way that these are the two things to learn about grammar and about language itself. Learn how words work and how they mean things, and learn how the rules work. But Pinker would acknowledge, too, that that's a really fuzzy boundary. So let me give you another example here. The horns of the cow were long, and the cow's horns were long. Are those two sentences the same? Well, if you compare them straight up, in other words, if you went and tried to search for one online or something using a Google search, you would not say they were the same. There's different letters in them. There's a different string of ASCII characters. If you eventually converted it into a long, long, long binary number, which is what Google does when it searches for things, it would be different. But notice what we've done. We've taken something that seems syntactic, an arrangement of multiple separate words, of the cow, and squished it into one ending. So that's grammatical. It's actually called an inflectional ending, and we'll get to that in some future lectures. Now let's add some more cows. The cow's horns were long. And here's the drawback of the recording process. You can't hear any difference between one cow's horns and the horns of a whole herd of cows. We indicated that plural by apostrophe S. And we don't usually pronounce the second S. We could, right? We could cows's or Jones's. We do it with proper names, but not with common nouns. But when it's spoken, there's no difference. Now, let me give you one more thing with cows, and I'm done with cows. The cows had long horns. Now, again, we have the same sound, cows, but now we've changed were to had. We're still indicating past tense, but we've changed the verb, and now it's obvious that cows is plural. Now, here's the thing. If you're a native speaker of English, none of this was the slightest bit difficult, which is why it's not the sort of thing covered in a traditional grammar book. But if you're learning English as a second language, or if you're a technical linguist, then these sentences and their really close similarity and their somewhat different meanings are both interesting and challenging. How can such small changes, sometimes not even hearable changes, make big changes in meaning? And this is the mystery that has fascinated linguists for the entire history of the discipline, going all the way back to the ancient Indian grammarians and continuing through the 19th century philologists and coming up to today. This is the mystery of grammar. In fact, some linguists would say that grammar is what really separates the humans from all other animals. Did you know that? I mean, dolphins, they split infinitives all the time. Dolphins, dangling participles. Oh, just forget it. They use who and whom wrong. Oh, I'm kidding. But grammaticality is one thing that's usually missing from the animal language studies. So we have a couple examples of really extraordinary seeming animal language competence. If you remember Coco the gorilla, who would speak in sign language and supposedly said I love you to her pet kitten and talked about watermelon as a drink fruit and so forth, she didn't have grammar. Not even the people who claimed that Coco could speak things claimed that she could distinguish things grammatically. And this is really important. And in fact, one of the problems with the Coco study and some of the chimp studies is they brought in people who were fluent in sign language. So not primate researchers, but actual people who'd grown up deaf who spoke fluent American Sign Language. And they didn't really think that the gorillas or the monkeys were really speaking in sign language. They said they're just moving their hands around. It's you researchers who are seeing a lot of stuff there. And all these animals can do is mark out individual words. But there's been some animal language studies that suggest a little bit more competence. For example, there's a chimp named Kanzi. And Kanzi's mother was subject in one of these language experiments, but Kanzi then learned the language really, really young, much younger than a chimp otherwise could, and he seemed to be much better at it. So there was some thought for a while that maybe Kanzi has language. Maybe it's the first chimp to be able to use language. He didn't have a grammar, couldn't rearrange words and create novel meanings that way. There's supposedly a parrot named Alex who does understand some basic grammatical relationships. But I'm going to steal Steven Pinker's metaphor here. When we get into these animal grammar, animal language studies, it's kind of like we see this rat pushing around things with its nose and maybe bonking things with its nose. And we say, aha, that's where the elephant's trunk came from. The difference between what the elephant can do with its trunk and what a rat or a hyrax can do pushing things around with its nose is just an enormous gulf. And that's the same thing with human grammar versus any other creature's grammar, including the dolphins and the chimps and the parrots and everything else. Grammar is remarkable because it allows us to do many of our most remarkable human tricks, not our stupid human tricks, but our very smart human tricks. We can arrange words, as I said before, to express an infinite number of ideas. Think about that. We have a finite number of words, and we can produce an infinite number of sentences. In fact, I can show you how to produce an infinite number of sentences right now. Think of the longest possible sentence you can think of. You can go get one from Faulkner. You can go find one in James Joyce. Supposedly the longest sentence in English language was 735 words in James Joyce, in Ulysses. It's the longest published sentence. But that's nonsense, because I could just say, Professor Drought said that the longest sentence by James Joyce was, and then repeat that sentence. And then you can tell your friend, I heard that Professor Drought said that, and add the sentence. You can make the sentence longer and longer and longer. You can, in fact, embed things inside it. You can embed it parentheticals. You can have something down at the end. So with this finite number of words, and actually a small number of rules, we produce an infinite number of sentences. Infinitely long, infinitely varied. That's a remarkable mathematical system. Now, the great grammarian, and yes, there really are great grammarians. I have like my favorite set of grammarians. One of my very favorites is Otto Jespersen. He wrote that language is nothing but a set of human habits, the purpose of which is to give expression to thoughts and feelings, and especially to impart them to others. And that's the other key point about the system. We're going to be talking more about that key point later in the course, but I don't want us to lose sight of it right now. We've defined grammar as an abstract set of rules that we can use to produce meaning. We put different things together. We organize different words. We even have it filtered down to the morphology with things like apostrophe S or with dental preterites, which we'll get to, but which is basically saying ED at the end of a past tense. But that's all abstract. And it's really important to remember in the social sense that it's a set of human habits. Let me quote Jespersen at you again one more time. No linguistic system is either completely rigid or perfectly harmonious. And this is another key point. When people invent artificial grammars like Esperanto or Klingon or Elvish, they become completely consistent, right? There are certain rules. There's only one way to do a past tense. There's only one way to do a future tense. There's only one way to make a plural. But natural languages don't work that way. And that's just how I want to wrap this lecture up, by thinking about this for a second. Noam Chomsky is famous for saying that human beings have a grammar organ. And I love this idea that we had some kind of organ like the liver that excretes grammar everywhere. Of course, he means the brain. But he's talking about that there's a grammar organ, there's something special that produces grammatical structures. And cognitive psychologists have looked into that, and they actually disagree. They would argue that you can build up the things you need for language and grammar from a lot of other separate modules of the human brain, so for audio perception, for understanding patterns, and so forth. That's not what's really important to us. What's really important to us for the purpose of this course is to understand that the rules of grammar evolve organically out of our brains and are connected to the ways we speak. And yet somehow they have this sort of abstract, almost mathematical perfection to them. And the only way to really understand how that could work is if somehow grammar is natural to the brain, but it's also influenced by whatever environment you're in to a great degree. This is why if you took my son when he was first born and brought him to China and set him down in China with a Chinese family, he would grow up speaking fluent Chinese. And likewise, if you took a small child that was born in the New Guinea Highlands and brought him and had him grow up in my family, he would grow up speaking fluent English. English is fluent. The rules are understood without ever being taught, as far as a linguist is concerned, about grammar. But yet there are some universal patterns, and this is where we want to go to understand how this all works. But we are not going to stay up at this abstract and mathematical level, but we're going to move right down to the practical. How do we say that the horns belong to the cow, or that there's more than one cow, or that the cow is being ridden by a red panda, or that the red panda is just a bleeping raccoon? We're going to learn the specific rules and the underlying structure, and that's where we're going to go with this course. But we need one more building block to set this all up before we get to the real practical improving your grammar step by step. And that is, we need to understand how English got this way. So in our next lecture, we're going to go from abstraction to history. And we're going to look at the history of the English language and how English became the language it is today.
This ends Lecture 2. If you borrowed this course from a public library and would like your own copy of the course guide for future reference, call Recorded Books at 1-800-636-3399 and we'll send you a free copy. A shipping charge will apply.